The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, proudly brought to you by APSA, Corporate and Investment Banking, the bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going during this COVID-19 crisis. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show this evening. Richard Brasher standing by. We'll chat to him in just a moment. The results out of Pick and Pay today. Lots of interesting things to talk about. So we'll pick up with him in just a moment. Eric Levenstein from Worksmans is worried that we don't have enough business rescue practitioners. It's very much a sign of the times. We're told by SIPS, the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, that 120 companies have applied for business rescue. We know the big ones. We know Edcon, and we know Comair, and we know Pumalela, but there have been 117 others at least. Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros, and I'm afraid Andy may be a little irritated with me. We'll see how that goes. Rona Kapoldis in London with our Africa Business Report. And then Mandy Collins, who is somebody who freelances. She writes. She works extensively with large corporates. And she's in a constant battle with companies about getting paid, about getting treated fairly, about being paid decent rates. And she thinks that actually big companies can learn a lot from people like her. People like her who are solopreneurs. What's a solopreneur? We'll find out later on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious.
Well, a small dip in annual profits for Pick and Pay in its most recent financial results, but the share price fall today, more to do with its decision to not pay a dividend. By the close, the share was down in double digits, 15% to 50 Rand 58 cents. Richard Brasher on the line to us from Cape Town. He's the chief executive of Pick and Pay. What's your specific concern that requires you to preserve this capital right now, Richard?
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. Well, I just think it's prudent, to be honest. I mean, we did give it a lot of consideration. I think we had a pretty strong result last year in the context of the economy. You know, our South African business was up 15%, and therefore normally we wouldn't have blinked twice and issued a dividend at 1.3 times cover, and it would be about 900 million rand. So, and our shareholders, I know, expect us to give a dividend. I think in these uncertain times, anybody who can predict what the liquidity situation is going to be in 3 to 6 months' time is clearly a better man than me. And we concluded that prudence was the better part of valor on this one, and that we deferred it rather than we said that, some people used the word scrapped. We haven't scrapped our dividend. We aren't spending our dividend. It's sitting there. And we will reflect on it when we know more, because no one really knows quite the ebb and flow and the twists and turns of COVID-19, sadly.
A lot of people would be surprised by your conservatism around this, because you've traded through the lockdown. You would have seen that huge surge in sales in anticipation of the lockdown. Through the lockdown, people have still been shopping at Pick and Pay. There have been queues around the corner with the social distancing. You haven't necessarily seen a decline in the value of stuff that you're selling. Why are you as apprehensive as you are? You're not an airline. You're not a horse racing company. You're not a pure clothing retailer like Edcon. Why would you be afraid of cash flow?
Well, I don't think we're afraid of it. We're just very conscious. You know, I've lived through a few crises in my career of 35 years in retail, including the downturn in 2007. And I think that all we've done is deferred a decision until we're clearer. As you say, we're a robust business. We don't have any long-term debt, and we have good commitments from our lenders to see us through. We pay our bills on time, we pay our suppliers on time, and we pay our staff on time. The impact of COVID-19 clearly wasn't in the results, because our results are to the end of February. But if you take the recent lockdown, you know, although our food and grocery business, and we're proud to be feeding the nation with our competitors, because it's a great honour and privilege to do that, but 20% of our product is not available for sale because the rules of engagement from the government have denoted it to be non-essential. So we've obliged and complied with that. But that is 15 to 20% of the turnover in a business, and therefore it will have an impact. As I'm sure when you talk to other companies who've had an even greater impact because the only thing they sell is clothes or the only thing they sell is liquor. So I think it's not, I don't think people will come through this process unscathed. However, you know, maybe Zoom or Netflix, maybe something like that. But I think the majority of us in the normal real world will find that this is a particularly taxing time, both professionally and personally. And therefore, I think prudence is, and we're a conservative business, as you well know. Mm-hmm. Over the years, we've not tried to be that racy. You know, we haven't been heavily borrowed. And the board have made this decision, and in fairness, I wholeheartedly recommended it, and I believe it to be the right one.
And what makes this all the more prescient, I suppose, is that your chairman is Gareth Ackerman. He is the heir to the Ackerman sort of hand in the business, I suppose. And the Ackermans are very substantial shareholders in the business of Pick and Pay, and by deferring the dividend, they too are saying, hold on a second, you know, we can wait until there's some clarity. And I mean, that is testament then to this decision, I would suspect.
Yeah, and I would reassure all shareholders, in fairness, and customers, is the Ackermans will always do the right thing by the business. And I wouldn't overplay the significance of the statement today, because obviously you've seen it impact our share price. But I think we have every intention of paying a dividend in the future, subject to things working out hopefully better than maybe some commentators suggest. And I think it was a sensible and brave move by our chairman to support it, given that they are one of the major shareholders. And I think it puts the business in a very strong place to navigate our way through this crisis.
What sort of signals will you be looking for in order to say, okay, we feel comfortable now to release this cash, which you say is ring fenced and it's sitting, it's not going to be accessed unless it really needs to be. But what sort of signals will you be looking for? I mean, down to stage two, down to stage three, a vaccine. I mean, what's the idea?
Well, some of the things obviously are not within our control. I mean, we don't control the banking fraternity and the way in which they look at liquidity, and therefore obviously any positions that we take in terms of short-term cash and overdrafts and the like. So obviously if the country and the banking area seems to be solid, you know, and there isn't a restriction in cash, then that's one thing. Secondly is how we run our business, which hopefully we can always run it better. I think we did a half good job last year, but I think we can do a better job this year. And I think in terms of as the market opens up, so obviously if the market opens up and we can sell more clothing and liquor and tobacco and general merchandise, which currently are restricted, then clearly that improves our cash flow, improves our liquidity, and therefore makes us more capable of releasing a full dividend to our shareholders.
I mean, it must be maddening for you. It must be maddening for your retailers, your managers of stores, the independent retailers who operate franchises. The madness of blocking off goods on shelves, putting police tape or red and white tape over the shelves to say, terribly sorry, you're not allowed to buy this because this is not an essential item. And if you're looking, I don't know, for a spade or whatever the case is with these things that have been banned, or at one stage clothing under level 5, I mean, it just defies logic. Or do you see it differently?
Well, it doesn't come naturally to us, I can tell you. Our job is to try and sell things, not to sell them. But you know, we're a legal business, so we comply with the letter of the law of the country. I mean, I think what I would say is that this is a very difficult time for everybody, whether it's government or business, and we're all going to have to take difficult and brave decisions. You know, I can't comment on the specifics for obvious reasons. We have hit it pretty hard here. You know, I'm well connected around the world in terms of retail, and I'd say that this is more extreme than in other places. But that doesn't mean that we're wrong and other people are right, because in fairness, there's quite a number of different games being played. I mean, let's hope that we can in this process protect lives and also protect the economy. And I think that, you know, that it's not a binary choice. It's not one or the other. It has to be finding the route. And I think probably being in charge in government and politics at the moment is a hell of a lot harder than being in opposition.
Or being in retail, even, potentially.
Sure. But Bruce, as you well know, it's always been hard. so this isn't a new deal for us. It's just a very unexpected, unwelcome and challenging situation.
Have you noticed big changes in shopping patterns? I mean, are people buying in bulk? Are they buying differently? Are they ignoring certain lines? Certainly, we know there was a bit of a run on toilet paper, but that calmed down, thank goodness. Have you noticed big changes? What are big set changes over the last 6 weeks?
Yeah, there's been quite a few changes. I mean, obviously, in pre-lockdown, those 3 days were a bit crazy, you know, so that despite best efforts, just people not to panic, you know, human nature being what it is. So, you know, you had sort of extremes of people hoarding frozen sweet corn or tinned corned beef or bottles of Absolute vodka. So there was a whole extreme, and obviously the worldwide theme of toilet paper, which presumably some people have got enough to last them through until their dotage. What we've also seen is a slight change in behaviour. So obviously the weekends aren't really the weekends anymore. So shopping patterns have slightly moved earlier in the week. You see people shopping less frequently but bigger baskets. And, you know, as a friend of mine in America quoted, I think, in his results, he said that we're now entering the sort of hair colorant stage of the lockdown. And so we have seen spikes in, you know, people have become full-time bakers. We have struggled to keep up with the flour and yeast demands as people stay home and have to feed the family three times a day.
And spices and desiccated coconut, for goodness sake. I mean, there must be some supply chains that are taking strain. I mean, there must be parts of the supply chain that aren't holding up. And I mean, I use desiccated coconut because it's something I'm looking for and I can't find it.
Well, we'll look out for some, Bruce. But to be honest, I would say, you know, quite often retailers don't have good words to say about their supply base, but I think that they've done a remarkable job.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at the performance of the agricultural sector and the protein sector in making sure that we've got product to sell everybody every day, and I think pretty much we have. We might not have everything every day, so I'll get on the coconut front. I think the thing that's taken people a bit by surprise is obviously there's certain things that people, obviously they wanted sanitizers and what have you, so that's taking a bit of time to get it fully back to normal. Toilet paper, as we talked about, and that's coming back to normal. And then it starts to be that people's behaviors of what they think is non-essential, they don't buy as much of, but they seem to have a fixation with things like spaghetti. So as we catch up with them, the manufacturing demand has to then sort of reach out. And I think that, you know, a credit to everyone's flexibility and ingenuity to actually be, I think, as normal as possible in an abnormal world with social distancing and queues to get into shops. But actually, when you get into the shops, I think that, you know, the team have done a very good job of keeping them hygienic, well spaced, and safe places to go.
Richard Brasher, thank you. Chief Executive of Pick and Pay. I was chatting to the owner of my local Pick and Pay the other day and just saying, boy, you got a lot of toilet paper. He says, yeah, nobody's buying it anymore. Because so many people had stocked up and bought so much of the splint and stuff that they then went and stocked up in anticipation of continued demand. And suddenly demand dropped off a cliff because nobody had any room left for the blimmin' stuff.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Well, markets had a really good day until about an hour before the close and then just ran out of steam by the end, down 100, up 116 points, I beg your pardon, to 50,319. Wayne McCurry from FNB Wealth and Investments, this wonderful disconnect between what is happening in stock markets and what is happening in the real world, the Wall Street versus Main Street phenomenon, where we've got 120 companies, according to SIPS, that have filed for business rescue, yet stock markets are 10% below their pre-COVID highs. I mean, this weird disconnect that a lot of people are struggling to get their heads around.
Crisis? What crisis, Bruce?
Exactly. I mean, it's insane, yeah.
Yeah, the stock market is clearly wrong, which it could easily be, which in fact we think the stock market's wrong, the rally is too quick, too fast, or the stock market's just looking through this and saying it will come to an end, which we know it will. I mean, that's a fact, it will come to an end. And the economy will recover, and there's lots of free money around, and interest rates are low, and yeah, so yes, we'll have to wait and see. But if 2 months ago, a month ago, wherever the market hit that 38,000 level, if you had said it would be back at 51,000 or 50,000 in a month, you would have been taken to the hospital to make sure you weren't infected with some strange brain disease, because no one would have believed you. And yet that is a fact. That's where we are.
It's astonishing because in the real economy, I mean, 120 businesses have applied for business rescue. Deals are falling over. Bidvest managed to get out of the Equestria deal. There was a technicality there. And today I see Barlow World has managed to get out of the Tongaat Hewlett starch deal.
They're trying to get out. It's going to arbitration because Tongaat disagrees with them that it's a material clause. I can't quite remember the phrase. But Barlow said, something's happened. We don't want to buy anymore. There's this clause in the contract that allows us an out. And Tongaat says, no, this clause doesn't allow you an out, so they're going to arbitration. But yes, Bruce, I mean, the economy is in devastation. I mean, I don't know which number's right. I've heard between 1 million and 6 million people have lost their jobs in South Africa. But, I mean, the economy is totally in tatters. It will recover. We have seen this before. It's never happened so quickly, though. It's never, ever happened so quickly, but yet the stock market, I mean, our stock market, you know, it's 15-odd%, 16-odd% off the record high. And quite frankly, 15 or 16% down is nothing.
Yeah, it's an astonishing performance. But then you get the Pick and Pay results. And Pick and Pay, they're a very solid management team. They're very conservative in the way they operate their business. We've been chatting to Richard Brasher now.
Yes.
And this decision to not pay this dividend, but to hold on to it, to defer it. It's not saying we won't pay it, but we'll just pay it at some point in the future if we don't need the capital. If all goes to hell in a handbasket, at least we've got some capital to tide us over for slightly longer. That's sort of the thinking that's happening within within that particular business. And people and companies are having to do unusual things in a desperately unusual time.
Correct. And if you think you're going to get a big dividend in sometime this year from your investments, you have to think again, because this is just the start. I mean, the other reasons why the Pick and Pay share price fell so strongly today, in the results were all pre-COVID, as Richard said in the interview, but they weren't good results, eh?
No.
I mean, Pick and Pay's been losing market share, and people, to be honest, have been waiting for the Pick and Pay turnaround for a very, very long time now. And I'm not sure these results showed a Pick and Pay turnaround, but obviously not declaring the dividend in a company like Pick and Pay that is very well capitalized. I mean, there's no question that it's not well capitalized. But it's only the start. I mean, Capitec deferred their dividends. And I would think that, pick a number, 80% of the JSE companies listed will either cut their dividend quite substantially or defer it. Not by market capitalization, because the really big companies, British American Tobacco, Naspers, Prosus, will probably pay the dividends out. So some of the big companies, the mining companies, the platinum companies, the gold companies, they'll all pay dividends. So it won't be 80% by value, but it'll be 80% by number. That will either going to significantly cut their dividends or pass their dividends.
I mean, talk about Prosus and Naspers. I mean, those shares have held up so well,
yes,
and they've continued to rally this week in anticipation of Tencent results, which will be out in the next 6, 8, 10 hours in China.
Yes.
If those aren't as good as the market is expecting and coming out with bells and whistles and vuvuzelas even, our market could be in for a pounding.
Yes, it could, but the results would probably be okay because we know one thing that people are doing during lockdown, and that's downloading games. Now, Tencent is a lot more than just gaming, but its revenue is gaming, effectively, at the end of the day. I know there's advertising and all of that, but it's gaming. So the results should actually be okay, but we'll have to see in a couple of hours' time. But I don't think they're going to disappoint because they are one of the beneficiaries. So are all the FANG companies, most of them beneficiaries. I mean, we saw on Vodacom's results how much data use has gone up by. I mean, they might not make the same margin, et cetera, et cetera. But clearly, data, home entertainment, gaming is a big beneficiary of the lockdown.
Wayne McCurry, thank you. From Wealth and Investments, it's First National Bank.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going during this crisis. That's African Nacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Eric Levenstein from Worksman's Attorneys joins us in just a little bit. A concern that we just don't have enough business rescue practitioners. Who would ever have thought there'd be a shortage of business rescue practitioners? But apparently, it's like toilet paper and after the lockdown. Just you can't find it anywhere. No business rescue practitioners. On your next Money Show, we'll get the story behind the story of the soup kitchen Ladles of Love. The founder, Danny Diliberto, joins us. Also, consumer ninja Wendy Nola is finding lots of dirt in the lockdown. Lots of companies not behaving the way they should. And Business Unusual with Colin Cullis looking at the unusual side of business next time on The Money Show.
Bruce Whitfield on 702. Call Bruce on 011-883-0702.
Got your daily bedtime story from some of the best writing in the world, and we've got a fabulous tale for you tonight, as we always do, because there are so many remarkable bits of journalism being done all over the world at the moment. Well, the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission saying that since the lockdown began, more than 120 companies have filed for business rescue. And so these are the companies that we know of. Pumalela is one of them. Comair is one of them. Edcon is another. And there are 117 others. Some of them out of the public eye, of course, the vast majority out of the public eye. Eric Levenstein from Worksman's Attorneys is concerned, however, that there are not enough business rescue practitioners in South Africa to do the job of trying to save companies. Just how serious is this problem, Eric?
Well, Bruce, we have a schedule of business rescue practitioners published by the Companies Commission, and they say there's about 460 licensed practitioners, but only 97 of them are registered as what we call senior practitioners who would have had more than 10 years' experience. Now, when you look at the uptick in business rescue, as you just said, and we don't expect that to get much quieter, we are concerned whether or not there are enough business rescue practitioners to take on the bigger filings that are probably going to come our way in the next few weeks and months ahead.
And when you say the bigger filings, I mean, these are big companies. These are complex entities. They are technically very diverse and complicated. And for business rescue practitioners who, by training generally, are lawyers, there's a huge amount of learning that has to happen as people go into trying to rescue companies that even professional managers found they couldn't, run properly.
Correct. And in fact, the majority of business rescue practitioners, Bruce, are in fact chartered accountants or restructuring specialists. And we do have lawyers. We do have lawyers taking appointments as well. But it really is a balancing act between having some financial knowledge, ability to restructure companies, looking at balance sheets, income statements, looking at cash flow projections. So it's not something that people can just switch on that switch and run it. It's something that is quite difficult. And also, the objective, of course, is to publish a plan where creditors would look at and say, well, you know what, we'll vote in favor of this plan and we won't push the company to liquidation. So the skill set of the practitioner is critical. And we've seen it in some of the bigger filings, SAA, Comair, Edcon. You've got senior practitioners being appointed to run those rescues. They are complex, and they take time to land. And obviously, as we've seen, there are a lot of challenges, including interference prospectively from shareholders and the like. So it's not really something that anyone can take on.
Why is it such an unattractive career choice to become a business rescue practitioner? Clearly, there was a huge flurry of interest. More than 400 people are registered, but only a fraction of them are actually practicing. Is it not properly remunerated? Are the reputational issues of being associated with companies that fail because the vast majority of business rescues aren't instigated nearly early enough, so we don't have very many success stories of companies emerging out the other side simply because they held on too long before looking for help? What is the problem?
Patrice, you know, prior to 2011, all we had was liquidation. So we had obviously a lot of liquidators doing that kind of work. And in 2011, we got our business rescue legislation. And as we've progressed over the last almost decade now, we've seen an increase in business rescue practitioners registering with SIPSI. We, as I'm the chairperson of SARIPA, the South African Restructuring Organization, and we work very hard to encourage young chartered accountants, lawyers, to get interested in the business rescue profession because there's a need to restructure companies. Now, why that hasn't occurred to the extent that it has had is something which is quite surprising. Obviously, it is a fairly lucrative appointment. You've got tariffs that are set by the Companies Act, and you charge by your hourly rate. And as I said, it's a skill set which is peculiar to those that are interested in turning around companies. So hopefully in time to come, and particularly in this period now, we're going to see more people putting up their hands and getting involved in restructuring, either through organizations like SARIPA and others.
Does it not dilute the skill set if you're in an emergency situation, as we are at the moment, where, you know, suddenly a B-grade set of attorneys goes, you know what, here's an opportunity for us. We weren't getting many clients anyway. The lockdown's not been great for people breaking the law in the physical world. So let's go and become, or accountants, let's go and become business rescue practitioners. Is there not a risk that you don't get the very best of the best coming in and applying for this very, very important role in a difficult economy?
Well, Bruce, you have to be licensed by SIPSI to become a business rescue practitioner and to run a supervision of a company. And not only that, you also have to be a member of an accredited organization like SARIPA, like the Law Society, like the Turnaround Management Profession, and SAICA. So, you know, over the last 2-3 years, the fact that business rescue practitioners had to become accredited is an important factor because it upticks the skill set and the ability to do the job properly. And as I said, over the last period, we've seen more and more practitioners becoming what we call senior practitioners, but those are people that would have had 10 years experience. The junior practitioners, who would have had very little experience, often would get an appointment with someone more senior, and there's an element of mentorship and hopefully transformation in the profession. So, as I said earlier, we are hoping that more and more people get involved.
How fastidious are the member organizations? I mean, I mean, this is desperately unkind, but I can't help myself. Anoor Singh and Marcus Uster were members of SAICA, for example. And again, I forget whether they've been deregistered or not as chartered accountants. But, you know, no system is perfect. And I just worry that the opportunity for skullduggery lurks in times of uncertainty and crisis, unless the member organizations are particularly circumspect as to who they do and don't let in.
Well, I can talk certainly for SARIPA, the South African Restructuring and Insolvency Practitioners Organization. You have to be in good standing. Obviously, if there's an issue, there's a disciplinary process that takes place. And I've no doubt the same applies at the SAICA level as well. So, you know, I would think that if you belong to an accredited organization and you are in good standing and you've got a license with SIPSI, and you are put forward by a board of directors to take on an appointment like a restructuring through a business rescue process, you would have had to have ticked all the boxes and have had the relevant experience. I don't think just anyone who's decided one day he wakes up in the morning and wants to be a business rescue practitioner will be able to A, do the job, and B, would be put forward by the board. So I think there is a test feeding to this whole thing as to whether or not practitioners should be appointed in the particular matter, or it depends on the industry, it depends on which sector that person gets appointed to. Obviously, they're specialists for different companies.
Eric Lemonsine, thank you. An appeal, if you have the skills, if you have the desire, if you have the passion, if you have the ability, if you have the patience and the ability to withstand the lobbyists, then certainly there is a sector that is growing in South Africa. It's horrible that it is, but it is. And that, of course, is the business rescue practitioner space in the world at the moment. And companies need rescuing, but hopefully companies have learned also not to leave it too late. The first couple of years of business rescue in South Africa, it was made part of the Companies Act in 2008, were disastrous for the industry. And I think also undermined the idea of business rescue in South Africa because people tried to rescue their companies themselves before having the last-ditch attempt at being the practitioners. And hopefully they get a better deal in fixing companies that aren't too damaged.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Your Money Show bedtime story this evening. I hope you're getting to bed nice and early. Early to bed, early to rise makes a, it used to be a man, but a person, healthy, wealthy and wise, was what my grandfather used to tell me. So hopefully you're doing that. From the Guardian newspaper, it's a story of Elon Musk's latest antics. Elon Musk announced on Twitter that Tesla would resume production at its Northern California factory on Monday afternoon in defiance of a local public health order designed to slow the spread of coronavirus. Tesla is restarting production today against Alameda County rules, the billionaire chief executive tweeted. I will be on the line with everyone else. If anyone is arrested, I ask that it be only me. Musk's announcement followed a weekend of escalating threats by the entrepreneur against the county that is home to Tesla's only car factory in the U.S. in the city of Fremont. On Saturday, Tesla sued Alameda County, alleging that the local public health order violated California's constitution. Musk also threatened to move his headquarters and future programs to Texas or Nevada immediately and suggested the company may not continue to retain Fremont manufacturing at all. Musk has for weeks rallied against restrictions put in place to mitigate the spread of the virus, which has killed nearly 80,000 people in the United States and more than 285,000 people worldwide. The billionaire entrepreneur has become the most high-profile purveyor of misinformation about the virus, regularly promoting false messaging about the disease to his more than 34 million Twitter followers. Musk has also appeared to lend his voice to the fringe political movement, equating public health measures with government oppression, referring to shelter-in-place orders as fascist and tweeting messages such as Free America Now. Musk's most recent grievance stems from the fact that his factory is located in a part of California that has stricter rules for reopening than the rest of the state. On the 7th of May, the governor, Gavin Newsom, announced rules to allow some manufacturers to reopen on the 8th of May. However, the statewide rules do not supersede local restrictions if they are stricter. And in many of the state's most populous counties, including seven counties in the San Francisco Bay Area, have decided to keep in place their more stringent rules through to the end of May. On Monday, Newsom said during his daily press briefing that he was not aware Tesla had reopened, but he had great expectations that we could work through at the county levels, adding that we look forward to any and many decades of a relationship with Tesla. State law allows a fine up to $1,000 per day or up to 90 days in jail for operating in violation of health orders. Any arrests at the factory are highly unlikely. A spokeswoman for the Fremont Police said the department had not issued a single citation for violating the coronavirus public health order in the city of approximately 240,000 people, and that all matters have been mitigated through compliance. The spokeswoman referred to questions about Tesla to the county health public to health department and said we do enforce the order at the health director's direction, but we've been told they're in active talks with Tesla surrounding safety protocols. The Tesla plant has been closed since the 23rd of March. The factory employs about 10,000 workers. On Monday, the plant's parking lot was nearly full, prompting speculation that the company planned to defy the public health order even before Musk's tweet. Tesla says it has safety procedures to protect workers, including increased cleaning, enforcement of social distancing, providing of face coverings and gloves where needed, installing barriers between workers where necessary, and worker temperature checks at some locations. Alameda County had 2,101 cases of COVID-19 and 71 deaths as of Sunday. Elon Musk, Pretoria-born Elon Musk, defying the regulations and effectively challenging authorities in the United States to lock him up. Should they?
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, proudly brought to you by APSA, Corporate and Investment Banking, the bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going during this COVID-19 crisis. That's Africa Nacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show. On this Tuesday evening, we've got Andy Rice standing by. I think I may be in trouble with him. It's a Twitter thing. And then Ronak Kapoldis from Signal Risk will join us. And then Mandy Collins this evening is going to be joining us. She is a business writer. She is a professional who helps business people communicate better. She simplifies language. And she has been speaking a lot recently about the world that she occupies, which is the world of freelancers, or some people call themselves solopreneurs. It's a word I can learn to hate quite quickly, but it does explain exactly what it is. People who are entrepreneurial, who decide to work for themselves, by themselves, at home or from coffee shops or from rented office space, wherever it is, they choose that particular life for themselves, or they are retrenched and they cut a new groove for themselves, whatever it might be. But she believes that those people, particularly those with many years of experience, can teach large corporates a thing or two on how actually to run a business. It's a fascinating hypothesis. We'll test it at 7:30.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield.
Email him on brucew@702.co.za.
To Andy Rice, our branding and advertising expert, and I fear I may owe you an apology, Andy. And allow me to explain myself first, because I think this is important. Context is always important. I got complimented by a man from the advertising industry called Oresti Patricius on the beautiful design work on my book, The Upside of Down. And he went onto Twitter and he told me how clearly I'd been paying attention to your wisdom and all of your lessons about clarity and simplicity and boldness and color. And immediately I went, oh, no, it wasn't Andy. I set the record straight because I gave credit where credit was due. And I paid tribute to the remarkable people at Pan Macmillan. But I fear my hasty response and my not paying homage to your advertising, brilliance may have caused some offense, Andy.
Bruce, you are a man amongst men, and I certainly did not take it. Obviously, my humor is hard to judge, and the dividing line between what I try to make into humor and an apparent taking offense was not there, and I'm a great admirer of the design that's been done, and I don't want to claim any credit. I just thought you were a bit fast off the mark.
Andy Rice would never have a brilliant idea like that, is how you interpreted it, you see. But it wasn't like that at all. I was just determined to ensure that the people who had done the work, who I'm sure are students and scholars of your great work, which is how they made it brilliant in the first place, did such a beautiful job. Now listen, your hero this week is just lovely. Give me a sense of why you've done a non-advertising hero in an advertising feature. It's really interesting.
Well, it has a link to advertising because it's about a medium that is rising rapidly everywhere you look, and it's about a medium therefore being an advertising opportunity for brands who want to be brave and get there at the beginning. Having said that, our industry, despite being billed as being creative and open-minded and risk-taking, is in fact not that at all. The advertising industry tends to take a long time to adopt new media opportunities, and when they finally do, it's because the risk has been taken out of the opportunity because it's proved itself. Now, one that's fast on its way to proving itself, and I suspect is particularly appropriate for our current social and economic conditions, is the famous podcast. Now, what is a podcast, some of you might ask? Well, a podcast, in effect, sounds to the listener a lot like radio because it's an audio-only medium, except that it's delivered digitally and generally speaking, not on the old traditional broadcast method. And what podcasts are well, it can be as simple as a replay of a program you may have missed, through no fault of your own. So, for example, for the legions who are somehow finding something better to do than listen to The Money Show right now, they could catch up through your podcast, Bruce, and hear the thing again. But the element of podcasts that particularly attracts me and many others is
the creation of new materials, especially for podcasts. And then those are put onto digital platforms, and you can download them when you want. And then they create an exceptional new audio opportunity for recreation and relaxation for people who might be locked down or even in self-isolation right now. You can tune in and you can discover an absolute plethora of new worlds out there. On the Apple Podcasts platform alone, there are more than 250,000 different podcasts, and they cover everything you could possibly expect. So if you have a particular fetish for sneakers, then I would recommend Soulful, spelled the way you might if it's going for a pun. Sneaker stories from Vans to Adidas, Stan Smith, all sorts of things. All there, a complete podcast about sneakers. Or if you're a Mini Cooper fan, Stuart, what about White Roof Radio? Because the Mini Cooper has always traditionally had a white roof. There's a podcast devoted entirely to the ownership and love of Mini Coopers. And so it goes. Those are some of the international ones. And even my own favorite football club, languishing in League Two, has its own podcast called Under the Abbey Stand. That's Cambridge United's podcast. Audience of 3 or 4, I suspect. Locally, there is some terrific stuff. And if you look at the audience level for some of these podcasts, amongst the top ones are one called Alibi, which is a podcast that explores injustices out there. It's done by a combination of advocacy and journalism, and something about crime podcasts that all the world over are particularly popular. And this one is currently exploring a miscarriage of justice where a supposed criminal has been locked away for 17 years, and the Alibi people don't think that's the case or should have been the case. Marianne Tam, well-known journalist, has a very successful podcast called First Person, exploring ordinary people in extraordinary lives, and so it goes on. But the one that stands out locally, and therefore the one that is my hero representing the entire category of podcasts, is My Only Story by Dion Wiggett. And it's a harrowing but painfully honest podcast about his childhood and the molestation that he tolerated reluctantly, and which he has now come to face, the molestation by a teacher at his school. And it's so good, it recently won the Bronze Award for Best Serialized Podcast globally in the New York Festival's Radio Award. So hats off to Dion Wiggett as the flag bearer,
is an advertising guy as well. And what makes this made that podcast, and I listened, I was rapt by it for the entire duration of the podcast, and I need to go back and listen to it again, is it was done as live. It was, the first episode was done, and the moment Dion Wiggett knew, the moment he put out his first podcast, his quarry would be alerted. And what happened in the next 5 or 6 weeks was nothing short of extraordinary. By week two, the alleged abuser's business was shut down. People had been laid off. He ran off to the Southern Cape to go and hide with his mom. And Dion Wiggett said about a deep investigation week by week as it was happening. It was nothing short of extraordinary. Let's listen to a little extract, and then I have some money-related questions when it comes to podcasts, Andy, but have a listen to this.
2 years ago, I was an advertising copywriter here in Johannesburg, South Africa. The work was good. My husband was awesome. I phoned my parents once a week. Then, one Saturday, everything changed forever. 2 decades of my life just upped and left, and I was back in 1997.
And the goosebumps. I've got absolute goosebumps. Dion Wiggett's podcast is extraordinary. And the storytelling, the power of the podcast comes to the fore there in the way that old-fashioned radio documentaries that used to be broadcast on the wireless used to be. But the commercial opportunity here now, Andy, is really interesting because it allows advertisers to target niches. It allows advertisers to target numbers. If you've got a podcast that has huge listenership, then you can target numbers. You can play the numbers game. But the advantage here is the niche opportunity that advertisers can reach.
Indeed, and they can do it through sponsorship, for example, if there's a very clear editorial link between the content of the podcast and the message of the brand. But it's a digital platform like many others. So on the one hand, it's unique for its entertainment value, in my view, and apparently in yours. But it also is in the same category in terms of an advertising medium as your Facebooks and your Twitters, your anything that's digitally delivered. So when a media strategist is out looking for a particular online audience, then they would be evaluating both the quantity and the quality and the nature of that audience. So obviously a good starting point is big numbers. That helps enormously. It tends to be a kind of self-generating outcome. But the other aspect is, as you say, to find those niches, to get some kind of ability to slice and dice demographically and psychographically so that you can choose the podcast and the platform that is most suited and best value, best efficacy for your brand.
And also there is the intelligent use of podcasts. I mean, I'm going to use this and I state my vested interest up front. And we did a couple of seasons of solutionist thinking with RMB, and they said they wanted solutionist thinkers to be profiled. And so it wasn't ramming solutionist thinking down your throat, but there was the association of the brand, which is calls itself a group of solutionist thinkers. And that association was very strong with some of South Africa's great entrepreneurs, people who find solutions to problems. And it is a wonderful tie-up. I mean, it's that sort of lateral thinking that actually amplifies brands, drives audiences, and allows that sort of content to be created.
Absolutely, Bruce. And in fact, one of the top local podcasts is called Small Business MBA, which not that dissimilar to the solutionist thinking, but it's about helping entrepreneurs, helping those starting off with a business ambition to give them some clues and some tips and tricks to accelerate their progress. And yeah, I mean, I'm a bit of a nerd myself for the history of space exploration, and I'm on episode 338 of the space rocket history, learning all about Alexei Leonov's preferred underwear and all sorts of really exciting things like that. But you want to know something about a particular topic, I guarantee you, if you go and look in the directories and the Apple Podcast website, you'll find plenty to entertain and, as you say, educate you.
Yep, 13 minutes to the moon. Just lovely. And also, I just don't think we have enough comedy in the world. And there is, I mean, it's a hit and miss affair, but there is comedy on podcasts, and some of it is brilliant. Now, Andy, final one, your zero, please, for the week. And that is picking on a big Western Cape controversy.
Well, yes, this has been well covered, I think, in the Western Cape initially. It's not a story that really came up to the Johannesburg part of the world, but it doesn't really matter because the issue is important wherever you may be. Now, I'm not really a fan of outdoor media. A lot of people have said I've got a bit of a witch hunt going on. I don't think that's entirely fair. It's not so much the medium itself that I have problems with. It's usually some of the behavior of people behind it, whether they be the metropolis people, the city staff who are allocating sites, or whether it be the media owners who've got the sites. And I think there's a certain amount of smoke and mirrors going on there. But there's been a particular case in Cape Town now where the managing director of one of the big media owners, independent outdoor media, Brent Daisel, he rallied his competitors and colleagues, and they erected 27, I think it was, very substantial billboards all around the greater metropole of Cape Town, with carrying the simple message, stay home if you can. And they got all the right permissions other than from the Environmental Control Department in Cape Town. And as a result, they were instructed to take all these sites down. And there was a big threat of litigation and all sorts of things going on. And as Daisel says, we may not have followed every last letter of the law, but we're doing it because we are patriotic South Africans who believe in doing our best to contribute to the fight against the coronavirus. And it's as yet still unresolved, but the Cape Town City Council, in my view, has kind of backed themselves into a corner, because the letter of the law, as I mentioned, says that they are right, and that Daisel did not, as far as I can make out, did not get every last box ticked and I crossed and dotted and everything else. They acted on the basis of, well, that's more than my job's worth. And they responded, I think, insensitively. And really, the opportunity was for them to come out as the good guys in this, to have used their media relations expertise and their advisors to turn a difficult situation where in theory, they should go a certain route and spin it on its head and become part of the whole thing without setting precedents that might come back to bite them at some point in the future. I think the Cape Town Council, Cape Town City Council, therefore gets the zero for taking an issue where they weren't technically to blame and managing somehow to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory.
Andy Rice with our heroes and zeros this week. Fascinating discussion. Thank you, Andy Rice, with heroes and zeros tonight here on The Money Show. In a moment, we are going to do our Africa Business Report. That's coming up in a few moments.
The Africa Business Report.
Rona Kapoldis is a director and Africa analyst at Signal Risk, on the line to us from London this evening. Which countries on this continent of Africa, Rona Kapoldis, are managing this crisis best, and who's not managing at all?
Good question, Bruce. Bit of a mixed bag, of course. There's some good, there's some bad, and there's some ugly, and difficult to generalize about the entire continent. But I think, you know, before I answer that question, I think when you look at the way countries have managed this crisis, it's kind of a bit like a triathlon, because you're dealing with a triathlon of governance over here, where you've effectively got a political, economic, and a public health dimension to this long-term race that you're dealing with. And of course, that's very similar to the disciplines that are in a triathlon, like swimming, cycling, and running. So a bit of a mixed bag, you know. Some of the standout performers in our minds are Mauritius and South Africa, that have reacted quickly with evidence-based policies and communicated quite transparently early restrictions, early lockdowns, and from a public health standpoint, they've done quite well in terms of creating the social compact as well. Then, of course, you've had some outlandish behavior, the likes of Tanzania, which is relying more on religion to formulate policy rather than science. And in Madagascar, where, you know, this herbal remedy is being pushed as the antidote to COVID-19. So a bit of a mixed bag from a country perspective, but from an institutional and organizational perspective, I think the AU has been quite impressive and quite proactive. The Africa CDC was quick out the blocks. They convened an emergency meeting with health ministers as early as February. They provided technical and logistical support to a number of countries, and a number of the other mechanisms, including the special envoys that President Ramaphosa, as his position as chair of the AU, have put forward, have been quite instrumental in putting forward a proactive common African position and managing the crisis quite well with limited resources from that perspective.
What are the political ramifications of this thing? Because some governments will be criticized no matter what they do. They're locked down, the economy gets hit, they're going to get nailed at some point because people are going to lose livelihoods. And so that becomes a problem, despite the fact they save lives. Some will try and save livelihoods rather than lives and will be criticized for the pile of bodies that results. I mean, is there a win-win for anybody in this thing?
Well, I think the first thing is to think about the problem differently. We're thinking about this very much in either-or terms, where it needs to be both and. It's lives and livelihoods, people and the economy. It's lockdowns and tracing and tracking. So, you know, obviously the limited resources and personnel and financial constraints to this, but ultimately this is where the trade-offs and the complexity of policymaking come in. But kind of beyond the immediate firefighting that politicians are doing, you know, there are broader questions around elections. For starters, will elections take place in in countries like Cote d'Ivoire and Tanzania. You know, the elections typically on the continent are costly affairs. What does this mean if they don't happen for the legitimacy of the government? How do political opposition parties react? Lots of uncertainty about that. And then we're also starting to see some authoritarian opportunism and creep over here where, you know, because governments have had to take executive control and you're seeing big government coming to the fore, there are a lot of abuses of power with regards to the military, with regards to executive overreach, with regards to not respecting constitutional protocol. And we've seen that in the likes of Egypt. So that's something we need to watch. But also, you know, on another note, we're looking at the relationship between citizens and their governments, because to actively manage this crisis, governments are going to have to disrupt themselves positively and actually govern effectively, which needs to be demanded by citizens in these countries. So, you know, there's a possibility that, you know, elections become effectively referendums on the way the coronavirus crisis is managed. And maybe we do see some kind of shift in political accountability and improvement in governments. So, you know, we don't know which way this is going to go, but these are some of the themes that I'm watching quite closely.
I was chatting to Dambisa Moyo the other day, who's long been a critic of aid for Africa, and she's thinking differently about it now, given the scale of the crisis. And she was just saying it is surely in Europe's best interest to be supporting people on the African continent, to be supporting citizens on the African continent for Europe's own good. Because, I mean, the disruption that this COVID-19 could cause, the disruption to economies and lives and livelihoods, it could lead to the next migrant crisis, for example. And she's saying that, you know, the world needs to wake up to Africa's plight here, because there is a very good chance that this continent suffers deeply.
Yeah, I mean, you know, huge ramifications of a humanitarian and economic catastrophe if this is not managed properly. I think, you know, the argument has always been around a trade and investment relationship rather than a purely aid relationship. And, you know, given the impact on some of the industrialized economies, where the additional support will come from remains to be seen, particularly in a context of rising nationalism where domestic electorates are going to be demanding relief internally. So what you could actually see is that foreign aid is reduced towards Africa and that foreign investment is reduced as well as countries focus inward and internally. And I think in that context, I think the African Continental Free Trade Agreement becomes a really, really important initiative. It was supposed to go live from the 1st of July. Obviously, given the firefighting and the crisis management that's underway, that's not going to be possible. And policymakers have been pragmatic by pushing it out. But, you know, pushing it out too long runs the risk of compromising its credibility and the political momentum, which was really hard to achieve. And I think in that context of heightened nationalism, the retreat of globalism, and potentially more digitization and more localization, it becomes more important than ever for regional integration and to build local value chains. So, you know, I think we should be careful of you know, yes, there does need to be short-term relief, but ultimately for long-term sustainable solutions, I think, you know, there's still a huge opportunity for Africa via the regional integration initiatives.
Rona Kapolis, thank you. Director and Africa Analyst at Signal Risk.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going during this crisis. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Well, Mandy Collins is a writer. She's a business writing trainer. She is what some people might call a solopreneur, soon to become my least favorite word in the world. And I saw a really interesting idea she put forward the other day, saying that large companies could learn a thing or two about how to run their businesses in a crisis if they paid attention to the life of a freelancer. She's with us this evening on The Money Show on our How It Works feature. I guess this makes you an opinionista of sorts, Mandy.
Thank you, Bruce. You just could not resist, could you?
I couldn't.
I can't bear those terms that people make up.
But and solopreneur, haven't you used the term solopreneur? Because that's also another made-up
word. But I do think
one.
I put it in inverted commas. They're horrible words, but they do. You know, solopreneur does kind of sum up what you are. You're an entrepreneur, but you're kind of this one man or one woman show who has to do everything.
How is the lockdown going in Solopreneurville?
Well, so far, so good. Lost one or two smaller projects, but so far we are ticking over okay.
But not everybody's in that boat. I mean, many, many people in the world where they work for themselves have fallen on extremely hard times because generally there are quite a few people who consult on things like marketing and might be do some writing and might do help do some PR or whatever the case might be. And they find the moment that tough economic times hit, budgets get slashed, and it's usually the stuff that is outsourced that gets cut first because certainly companies don't believe it's that necessary in a difficult time, or there's less emotional connection to the people who are going to be let go than somebody who's spent the last 5 years sitting at the desk next to you twiddling their thumbs.
Absolutely. And that's why it's kind of important to try and make yourself indispensable so that when they do decide to cut you, they go, hang on, can we really do without him or her? And I mean, obviously that's very hard to do and it depends on what you do, but it's really about kind of nurturing those relationships and being helpful and making people's lives easier and also being creative and suggesting how you might help in a way that they haven't thought of before.
I've also seen your commentary at various times about the level of abuse that people like you take in terms of you're not the price makers. You're very often the price takers. You very often are people at the end of the queue when it comes to getting paid. And very often, and right now, there's a huge problem with people getting paid out of large companies and large organizations, despite all the bravado and the big promises that get made on a regular basis. I think we're sitting on a powder keg of disappointment when it comes to people not getting paid by large companies.
Well, you know, it's no different to the way it normally is. To be perfectly honest.
Well, that's okay then.
It's no worse than usual. I spend so much of my time chasing down people who, for example, you know, want something yesterday but are only prepared to pay you in 6 months' time. Or they put out charming little things like they will only pay you 60 days after statement, to which I normally respond with an immediate statement, and then get very confused accounts people kind of going, no, you're not allowed to do a statement now. You have to do it at the end of the month. And I go, well, that's not what your payment terms say. So it's just a constant battle. But I think the lesson is that you have to be tenacious and you have to continually say, I've done my part and your contract is to do your part. So kind of, you know, pay up.
The power balance, though, is not equal. I mean, it's very much so often people like yourself are treated like employees, but not with the same level of dignity and respect as employees are often treated because you're remote. But you get treated like a bad employee might be treated by a bad employer. Mandy Collins, who is a business writing trainer, she is a business writer. She does a lot of work by herself at home with a dog at her feet. And she, that's the way she likes to work. But she comes up with this theory that big businesses could learn an awful lot in a time of crisis from people like herself. We'll find out why she believes that and how big businesses can adapt the way they run their businesses for the betterment of not only themselves but their suppliers in a minute or two.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield.
Email him on brucew@702.co.za.
So very often people like Mandy Collins are treated like bubblegum under the shoe by the companies that they serve. Unless, of course, they've got beautiful relationships with the companies they serve and are treated well and add incredible value. And then, of course, the relationship is different. But Mandy Collins, what can big business learn from little old you? And when I say old, it's just a figure of speech, you understand? Oh, now I've offended her. Where is Mandy?
Thing is,
There she is. Let me do my spontaneous joke all over again.
I was just being rude to you.
We'll start again. What can big business learn from little old you?
Well, I think the thing that you learn when you work for yourself and it's just you and you have only yourself to depend upon is that firstly, you can't just do one thing, because if the rug is pulled out from under you and the industry changes, you've got nothing left. So you have to be really diverse in your offering. And, you know, a few years ago, the big word in business was disruption. Everybody was wanting to disrupt things. We are now in the midst of enormous disruption. And the new word now is pivot. Everybody wants to pivot. But what does pivoting mean? And I think what people like me do is that we try to pivot in advance. So, for example, when I started out, I was writing mainly health features for consumer magazines. That was my area of specialty. Now, if I do that, if that's 5% of what I do, it's a lot.
You did, because most of those consumer magazines in the last 2 weeks have disappeared.
Exactly. And the point is that I saw it coming a long time ago. I saw it coming in the fact that writers were being paid the same rate as they had been paid 15 years ago in actual rand terms. They are still being paid now, and people are trying to pay them less than that. So you kind of see the warning signs. You see the readerships drop. You see people scrambling to give a digital offering, trying to decide whether or not to put up a paywall, et cetera, et cetera. That's my industry. And I realized very quickly that that wasn't going to sustain me long term. And I had to start taking the skills that I have and applying them in other areas. And Gus Silber once said to me, you can retrofit a journalist into a lot of industries. And I think that's kind of what I've had to do, is go, okay, what can I do? So being a journalist, for example, teaches me to ask very, very specific questions that will get me to the answers quickly. If I go and interview somebody and I have to do a personal profile, for example, I've usually got 1 hour to get into that office, make that person feel comfortable with me, and tell me all their deepest, darkest secrets if I'm having a lucky day. The kind of thing that wouldn't be polite to ask over a dinner table to a complete stranger, I have to ask.
Isn't that the best part of the job?
But that has taught me to ask questions that will get me the information I need fast. Mm. That is a very useful skill in a business setting in all kinds of ways. It makes you a good coach. It makes you a good strategist. And so you can take those skills and use them in other ways. And it's about being creative, about saying, what can I do? What can I offer? And how can I offer it to the broadest possible number of people? And I think that's something that a lot of freelancers have to do. If you specialize too much, you run the risk of becoming obsolete in one way or another.
When it comes to learning, though, for a big business to learn from somebody who works from a converted garage, a converted bedroom, in their backyard, at their kitchen table, mm-hmm. or however freelancers work, big business looks down, generally, I think, at many people who choose to operate that way. It's sort of like, oh, it's not a proper job. So how do you get them to take the lessons from you seriously? And what can you teach them?
Well, I can teach them that, you know, you can spend a huge fortune on branding and a beautiful reception area and, you know, gorgeous things on the walls and vision statements that sound fabulous. But if you don't deliver to your customers at the end of the day, you've just wasted a whole lot of money on unnecessary overheads. So, yes, I do work from a converted garage, but I'm not paying rent to anybody. And when I need to meet with someone, I go and meet them in a coffee shop, or I go to their meeting room. So they can learn to keep their overheads down and actually focus on what's important, on the things that help them to deliver to their customers. I can teach them about agility, because I can pivot very quickly, because I don't have a million egos who have to sign off on every single decision that I make. Mm-hmm. And I see this with the big companies that I deal with. You know, you put together a tiny brochure of like A5 or something, and it needs 20 people to sign off and correct the incorrect grammar, and usually they correct it incorrectly, you know, or put their little stamp of it on so they feel included. And actually, a lot of it is just nonsense.
That is one of the great constraints, of course, of somebody like yourself who then consults into large corporates. And when people feel obliged to justify their own existence, and we'll take up lots of airtime on the conference call and nowadays the Zoom call, where they want their face on screen so they're shown to have been in the meeting, it can become
absolutely
death by Zoomer.
Be careful, Bruce.
No, deliberate.
You know what? Meetings are problematic a lot of the time, whether they are on Zoom or whether they're in person. I have been hauled, you know, for a 45-minute drive to go and have a meeting with somebody on the other side of town where the meeting is literally over in 5 to 7 minutes. And often I've sat in meetings which are very, very long, in which nothing is decided, no action is taken, no one takes responsibility, and it's just a lot of hot air. So I think, you know, people have just taken all of their meetings and moved them online to Zoom, and I don't think that's the solution. I think we need to relook at why we meet. We need to look at how many of those meetings are effective, how many of them actually result in action with deadlines and with responsibilities attached to them. There's a whole lot of stuff that has to change. I don't think the solution is just to take everything we've done in person and move it on to Zoom.
You're absolutely right. And also, you know, make some tough decisions as to who actually needs to be part of that meeting, because so often it's a case of, well, you need to look busy so everybody go to the meeting so that everybody's in the meeting and the manager can keep an eye on them and know that at least they're all in one place. And it becomes a control game rather than a game of productivity. And from somebody like yourself, every minute of every day counts. Every cent of every budget counts. Every journey, every meeting matters. And if more people in large corporations took on board just those few lessons that you've been talking about this evening, they would find themselves running far leaner, far more efficient, far tighter ships. They may have a couple of noses out of joint and a few egos bruised, but frankly, that's probably overdue in many organizations.
Absolutely, because I think what they do is they turn their employees into children. And that's why they often are uncomfortable with freelancers, because they can't treat us like their children, and a lot of us won't stand for it. We are adults, and we manage our own time, and we have a deadline, and we meet it. And I think if people treated their employees a lot more like adults and let them decide when they are going to work in order to deliver that deadline, with realistic timelines, obviously, I think people would be healthier and happier, because they could decide, okay, I need to take little Johnny to the doctor this morning.
But I wonder, Mandy, if this experience may change some of that, because people are working differently and behaving differently. We'll get a taste for the life that you have, because many people have been forced into the environment that you have. And they're suddenly going, hold on a second, I quite like the fact that I don't have somebody breathing down my neck all the time.
They are, but I'm also hearing from friends who are going, I see why you had burnout for 3 to 4 years. They said there are no boundaries anymore. And no. I'm being expected to be on meetings at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, getting emails all hours of the day. So people have to really learn how to put boundaries down, and for themselves and for their teams.
It's a critical, critical learning that, Mandy, and thank you very much for sharing those lessons with us, because I think you're absolutely spot on. So many companies waste an infernal amount of time, not only their own, but people who consult to them, who work for them, people, just because, you know, it's just important just to meet you before we do something. And it's like, well, we could have met the day we were doing the thing, or you could just have phoned me, or we could have FaceTimed, or whatever it might be. I think those habits are hopefully going to change. And Mandy Collins' experience of many years of working with the sometimes smelly dog at her feet have held her in good stead. And she shared those lessons with us this evening on The Money Show.